NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. And today we're going to take a little different twist here in a minute. But first, it's just Todd and I today. And Todd is out in California and I'm on the East Coast. But today's adventure, I would like to have asked Todd to relive a presentation that he just gave in the last few weeks on UAVs. And, you know, we got a lot of different names for them, and I'll let you, Todd, explain that.
Well, very good.
But the material that Todd has been sending me, I find it to be very, very fascinating. And I've had a little bit of exposure into this years ago. So without any more of my blabbing, Todd, why don't you walk our audience through what's the latest on the phenomenon that we call, UAPs today?
Be happy to do so. And many of our regular listeners and viewers will know that over the past 2-3 years or so, we've actually done several shows related to UAP/UFO. UAP is Unidentified Anomalous Phenomenon, which is the new term that's used for what used to be called UFOs. Sort of like includes your classic UFOs plus other things that could be literally that, just unexplained phenomena. Now, part of the reason I was invited to a conference, at a conference was called Contact in the Desert, took place in late May and early June down in Palm Springs, was because of my history of doing this sort of thing. Even 10 years ago, I was on a show, I believe, on Discovery Channel, where several folks were talking about, notable UFO events involving aviation, including I believe it was a 1986 event up in Alaska, where a 747 was pursued by something. What it was, no one knows to this day, but it was something that was looked into by the FAA in a formal way back then. But more to the point of why I was there, I'm an aviation person. I'm an aviation safety person. Contact in the Desert is very much about the UAP/UFO world, including some of the folks that, even if you're casually looking on especially cable television about shows of this nature, a couple of the names that might be familiar to some in the audience, Stephen Bassett and Nick Pope, who Nick Pope is a former United Kingdom Ministry of Defense official who was involved in those kinds of reports back, I believe, in the 80s. There are a lot of other folks there, and I was, I guess, the token aviation guy. And my point was, there's stuff going on that has been of high interest in the U.S. since late 2017, when there was a New York Times report about naval encounters with unknown phenomena off the east and west coast of the United States. There's even been a move within the Department of Defense to formalize reporting of these kinds of events because they have concerns, safety of flight and national security concerns. And so too has the intelligence establishment. The Office of Director of National Intelligence had a report done back in 2021, which we talked about on a previous show, which discussed these issues. My concern is the following. How does this relate to aviation safety? First off, I mean, John, you can chime in on this. I don't know of a single report in the NTSB databases, the FAA databases, where there was a classic straight up UFO involved event, as in not just an aircraft that was unidentified, but something that fit the characteristics of classic UFO. I've never seen a single one. And I've looked at tens of thousands of reports over the years. How about you?
Yeah, I too have looked and continue to look, just looking for this program. We review, you know, many reports every week, and there's nothing. And I think part of that is because it wasn't until recently where they started to really take it a little more seriously. I mean, I think the government actually tried to tag people as being crazy who reported that they saw something. So the government would always poo-poo it and make derogatory or fringe derogatory remarks to say that they, you know, they're out there smoking something.
Well, I would say that even today, it would not be conducive to a career progression if you were to be front and center about this and you were an active duty military person or in the aviation world as a crew member or a flight attendant, in part because even though there's an acknowledgement that this stuff perhaps isn't silly, it's still, a bit of a lift, to inertial lift, to get an organization or a whole industry like aviation to look at this as an issue that is a straight up aviation issue. Just as it took years before wildlife strikes and bird strikes got to the point where you had formalized databases of this being reported. Same thing with laser encounters with aircraft and drones flying in places they shouldn't fly. They're all databases out there that you can send reports to, and it's formally tracked. In other words, there's a social acceptance in the aviation organizations of this world of certain kinds of risk. UAP/UFO hasn't gotten there yet.
But I believe it's there, though. I mean, some of these things, we've had Navy pilots, we've had airline pilots talk about strange phenomena. You got to take it seriously at some point.
And the military has actually taken some steps in that direction. They are actually working slowly to build databases of events for their own purposes. Now, unlike the civilian world, they might have a great database existing right now, but we're not going to have access to it. On the other hand, the civilian world, there's a lot of great databases out there that we have free access to 24/7. And that was the point of what I did before I did my presentation. I thought, is there right now, as we speak, a government database that is respected, that has information in there that is directly related to UAP, and that is freely available to the public? And the winner of that contest was NASA, the ASRS database, the Aviation Safety Reporting System, which we talked about on at least a couple of shows before, is that database. I heard from doing some conversations with folks and doing some quick searches of the database. There are actually a couple of events in there where people have anonymously reported. By the way, ASRS is an anonymous reporting system. Anonymously reported what they thought was a safety flight issue. And from reading the narrative, it looks like a UFO/UAP to me. And just to recap ASRS, it's been around since the 1970s. It is there to promote aviation safety in many ways, including if you, let's say, do an inadvertent accidental regulatory violation of the FAA and you self-report to ASRS, then you have some protection against getting any kind of sanction from the FAA. And another thing about ASRS, it's not just you write something, it goes to the database. You write something, they have a team of people to look at this before they put it into the database. Now, on top of that, you might have hundreds, actually, I think it's over 2 million at this point, a couple of million reports since the inception of ASRS. But the number of events that are actually in the online database that you can look at is in the tens of thousands, which means only a few make it. The fact that I found a fistful of UAP events was really surprising to me, but I'm getting ahead of myself. What I'd like to do is give you a quick run through of the presentation I made at what was called Contact in the Desert in Palm Springs. Lovely conference. People I don't usually work with. Again, these are people who are very much into the UAP alternate reality sort of thing. But I was there basically giving the same message I've given on a show. This is a potential safety issue. We should go ahead and look at it. And you see from the title slide, for those of you looking at the video version of this, this was entitled Using the NASA Aviation Safety Reporting System to Track UAP Events. And I did this without any help from NASA or the government. I basically did what any one of you could do. Ask some questions, figure out how to get those answers, and go after those answers within the database. Everything I've done, I've talked about here, you can do yourself. Quick summary. We already talked about how it's been recognized formally by the U.S. government, at least since 2021, as a safety of flight event. As of May, actually, we're doing this in almost August. As of July 2024, there really isn't any formalized either database or set of definitions, et cetera, that's within the FAA or the NTSB that talks about this issue. And if you had a database of these, and John and I are both confident that it happens all the time, it might be a very, very useful thing. ASRS, as I mentioned, is one where it not only has events in there, but because of the way it's structured, because it's an anonymous reporting system, and because every report that ends up in the database is vetted by a set of experts at NASA, this gives a whole lot more credibility than other alternative ways of reporting. And, you know, our goal here is to encourage the aviation safety community, excuse me, the aviation community to do things to enhance safety. And I'll, you know, give you the punchline here. If this is something that has happened to you, whether you're a pilot, mechanic, working the flight line, flight attendant, even pushing a broom on the ramp, and you see something that will affect aviation or aviation infrastructure or aircraft or people or equipment, and you think, this is really weird, this is unusual, I should report this to somebody. You should report it to the ASRS database. Going so forward.
Before you jump into your presentation, I went through a bunch of those, and a couple popped out. We mentioned that a safety issue with these events. And we had an airplane that had one or two of these unexplained things circling around the airplane, sort of pacing it, flying with it, on above it, below it, like almost like it was sizing it up. And two pilots on board that had clear views of it. And it's been a while, and it's been... It was in the period of time where people would poo-hoo you for saying it, right? And we even had an astronaut have a bogey that he couldn't explain up in one of the Apollo flights, and a very well-known person as well. And then the one that really got my attention was Chicago. And maybe you can talk to the Chicago event, because we did earlier, you and I.
Yes, indeed, the Chicago event. And let me make sure I'm getting the dates right here. This was at Chicago O'Hare. This was during a cloudy day, and this figures into it later on. There was something that looked like some round dish-shaped thing that was hovering above one of the terminals, in full view of people on the ground, including mechanics who are taxiing aircraft and pilots who are taxiing aircraft, other ground personnel. It seemed to hover in the vicinity of the terminal, somewhere under 1,800 feet, because I think that was a cloud deck, punches a hole through the cloud, disappears. Didn't hurt anything, didn't run into anything, but this was something that was reported in the newspapers soon thereafter. Hugely well-known within not just Chicago, but around the world. And there was no official response from the FAA. There was no investigation, no anything. And this, like you, this really ticked me off. It's like, this was 2006. 5 years after 9/11. 5 years after the TSA was up and running. November 7th, 2006 was the exact date. And here is something that was a clear violation of airspace, hovering over one of the most important pieces of aviation infrastructure in the United States. And it didn't have any hostile intent or hostile action, but you just can't float an aircraft over a terminal at O'Hare and not expect to get sanctioned by somebody. And there was nothing done. No report, no follow-up. And I said to myself, this is crazy. We've been paying these folks hundreds of millions of dollars a year since 9/11. And here is like a bona fide, straight up violation of aviation security, and you're doing nothing about it. That really got me going. It got me into looking into this in a deeper way.
I'm sure they did something, but it's just not going to tell anybody. You know, government doesn't like to admit they don't know either. So,
and you know, getting back to, is there a government database that is dealing with this? No, there isn't. Is there a government database that has stuff in it? Yes, there is, ASRS. But again, I'm getting ahead of myself here. Let me go through the presentation and get to a different part of it. You know, all of you who are regular listeners, you know my background well enough. But one of the key things about my background was back in 2000, I wrote a book called Understanding Aviation Safety Data. It basically was, what was the process I used when I was working in academia and at Boeing to analyze aviation safety events? Not the big ticket items where everybody knew about it, but let's say there is something that comes up as an issue that has a pattern of behavior that results in damage, injuries, or deaths, but there's not a lot written about it. How do you systematically ask the questions that helps you get closer to the answers you're looking for? Not things like, you know, what's the speed of the airplane when it hit the ground, but things like, has this thing event ever existed? What's the distribution of this event in time or in space? You know, what is the rate of this given certain other restrictions? So I looked at that when it came to this whole subject. There's not a lot of data out there. So you really can't answer questions like, what's the pattern of behavior state by state or year by year? Because there's not enough reporting. But the first question, which I had in my book, one of the key questions, does this thing exist, whatever that thing is? And with ASRS, yes, it does exist. There exist reports of UAPs and formal aviation safety related databases supported by the US government. And, you know, my goal for this presentation for this audience is to get you interested enough to look into this, especially if you experience this in any branch of aviation, whatever role you're playing, you observe something directly, experience something, and it's like, I'd like to write about this and send it to the government. Here's a way to do that. Now, the U.S. government's approaches to UAPs, we've talked about this before. Yes, there's interest. Yes, the military is doing something. Civilian agencies aren't doing so much. Now, here's the other thing about my approach to this. I like definitions. If you're going to say, what's a UAP? Okay, give me the definition. Right now, there's no standard definition across all branches of government. DOD has their definitions, and I'm flashing on the screen a definition that came out of an actual piece of legislation, the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2022, where UAP is an airborne object not immediately identifiable, transmedium objects or devices. That's like something that goes from water to air, from air to space. Submerged objects or devices that are not immediately identifiable in that display behavior or performance. Okay, you can read this if you see the screen. First, it's a long, complex definition. Second, we're in aviation. We don't deal with submerged objects. That said, let's move on to NASA's version. Objects in U.S. airspace not recognized as human-made or natural phenomena. Okay, that's a little bit broader than aerospace vehicles. Maybe real or sensor artifacts. Okay. Maybe a threat to aerospace safety. I agree with that. Maybe a threat to national security. This is a much more general definition that is more realistic because we're talking about something that is unknown. We're not talking about something that is definitely an aviation artifact or definitely this or definitely that.
So the sensor artifacts for our audience, why don't you expand on that discussion a little bit?
Well, I'll tell you one that which is going to be part of the presentation. A year or two ago, I happened to go outside my door, look up in the sky, right after sunset, directly coming at me was a string of lights, very steady lights, very slowly progressing across the sky, a whole flotilla of lights. And I knew that SpaceX had recently launched a bunch of Starlink satellites. And I was actually looking for this bunch of Starlink satellites. I looked like a day or two before, didn't see it. I happened to come out And I happened to see it coming straight at me. It was like spectacular. I knew instantly what it was. But if you had never looked up in the sky for satellites or didn't know this was coming, and you see not one, not two, but 50 lights on a train coming across the sky, you'd say to yourself, what the heck is that? And because of the altitude they were at and the speed they were flying in space, like 17,500 miles an hour, if you look up at it, it was going across the sky like you would see a jet in the stratosphere. So where's the sensor artifact? Well, it was flying through the trees, and I could see there were solid lights, and I could see them going in the tree branches. I whipped out my iPhone and started taking a video of it. If you see the video that's part of this video presentation, it looks like these lights are twinkling. So the sensor artifact was my eyeballs picked up the fact that they were flying between tree branches. But my iPhone, if you look at it, looks like these were flickering lights, not solid lights. So if all you had was that video, the sensor artifact is they look like they're flickering, but they're not. But you have to know there's a tree behind there, or in front of them, rather. Now, NASA's approach to unexplained phenomena, I'm putting this one up here now, applying rigorous scientific approaches to understand an observation. I'm all for that. Scrutinizing assumptions and intuition, transparently and diligently collecting data, reproducing results, seeking independent evaluation, reaching a scientific consensus about the nature of an occurrence. Now, this sounds NASA-like and scientific-like. I like this approach because we're dealing with something where we really don't know what it is. So you really just can't haul off and say, we got the data, let's do an analysis, here's the equation. Now, these are the kind of questions you ask when you have an issue that isn't quite well understood. Now, you know, John and I were talking earlier about earlier government studies about UFOs where, let's just say that it was a whitewash from the get-go. So you were talking about, what was it, Blue Book?
Yeah. Yes. And where they actually had eight scientists to boohoo everybody that reported it. You know, swamp gas and, you know, lights, all kinds of crazy explanations for things that happened instead of just admitting that, you know, it's something that we don't understand. But, you know, it seems like governments can't ever say, I don't know.
And governments, we can go into this a little bit further on. There's actually an organization that was started a couple of years ago within the defense and intelligence community called ARRO, the All Domain Anomaly Research Office, I believe is the name of it, which was tasked with understanding this phenomenon and giving a report to the public. And there are various opinions about what worthwhile thing ARRO did. But let's just say that the reports they've come out with aren't universally accepted as being, as this NASA approach, scrutinizing assumptions, being transparent and diligent in collecting data, reproducing results. They didn't follow the NASA model. Now, you know, when it comes to civilian accident and incident reporting in the United States, the short story is there's a lot of reporting going on. Some of it is mandated by regulation. If you have a certain kind of accident with injuries or severe damage to the aircraft, it has to be reported. If you don't, you're in violation of the regulations. So there's a huge incentive to do so. There are also certain safety issues which have become prominent in the last few decades, where there's actually a formalized reporting system just for that kind of event. Wildlife strikes aircraft, laser strikes aircraft, and drone behavior or illegal or dangerously operating drones, those are three that have stuff out there. And sometimes it's very, very good data. That is, there's details that you can go into. Sometimes it's very, very bare bones data. For example, the laser database might have the color of the laser, the location, the date, but not much else. You also have other reporting systems, ASRS being one of them, which is not mandated that people report it. Clearly, it's something that, because of the incentives that you have, especially if you have a violation of the FARs and you self-report that violation, the FAA can't turn around and ding you, because if the only place they see it is the ASRS database and it was not a deliberate action on your part, you're good. So they've ended up over the years having a lot of things in there, not just for avoiding sanctions, but also sometimes genuine safety events where people report, hey, this happened to me, here's how it happened, you know, please look at this. Now,
That database is unbelievable. I mean, I've used it myself for maintenance-related accidents to see if they have been reported elsewhere. And you mentioned earlier a couple of times about it being anonymous. It doesn't have to be anonymous. You can put your name on it. You can actually have a discussion with those people that analyze the reports you send in. And the vast majority of them do have the names on them.
Now,
But if
full
you're
disclosure,
concerned, if you're concerned, you don't have to put your name on.
I recently put in a report because of a separation issue I had when I was flying. It wasn't a very close separation issue, but when I was doing this presentation, I thought, okay, this is one event that happened recently. It's the closest thing to an airspace violation I've done. Turns out that, we were never in any danger, but just going through the process of going to the SRS database site, downloading the form, reading through the form, following the instructions, and submitting it. That was very useful because it made me sit down at great length, go through the data I had, and because of ForeFlight and things like FlightAware and whatnot, I could actually look at the flight tracks of both aircraft and add to that my reminiscence of when it was happening. And I had a much fuller understanding of what happened just by writing that up. Even if I'd never sent it to ASRS, that process was beneficial to me. So with UAPs, it could be the same thing. If for some reason you want to put pen to paper and make sure the what you saw you can retain and write it down, do so. If you want to submit it, it's anonymous. Do that too. But even writing it down, if you don't give it to anyone else, is a huge positive for you.
Just
Now,
understanding mistakes that people make helps you, helps everybody that looks at it. There's enough data, and I actually have some firsthand experience with identifying maintenance errors to the maintenance community, and then monitoring that event after we did a little training session, and how it just didn't reoccur again. So that transfer of information at the basic level, hey, I screwed up, and here's what I did wrong, and here's what I should have done, has a big effect on people, other people in the business. So all of this is important. That's why I just shake my head when I see that the federal government hasn't jumped in a bigger way with this. Maybe they're afraid that they're going to uncover something that the general population will get very unhappy with, apprehensive, maybe even worse, knowing that stuff exists. But there's something going on. All these people can't be just smoking something. There's something going on that we need to track and try to figure out.
broadly speaking, when it comes to military and civilian options for reporting, each military branch has its own systems for reporting UAP. Again, if you're in the military and aviation, you know that from service to service, there are very different ways that things are done, including reporting this sort of thing. I know the Navy's been front and center on this. The Air Force has been strangely quiet, but let's not go into that. The FAA has no current UAP reporting process other than referring to outside entities. Most safety databases that do exist, like the laser database, are pretty limited in scope. They don't have like a narrative section where you can go into what did the witness actually see, what was their impression, etc. Stuff that you can hold on to and get some insights from, like ASRS. There are many private UAP databases, but fewer promoted to the civil aviation community. There is one exception. The FAA suggests that you have an encounter or see something. You can either report it to the National UFO Reporting Center, which is run by Peter Davenport, who, by the way, was at the Contact in the Desert presentation, had a lovely conversation with him, or you can report it to local law enforcement. Now, that last part sort of stuck in my craw because local law enforcement does not have any jurisdiction over the sky. I mean, maybe if you have a noise complaint or you're flying your airplane too low and you're bothering people, that might be of a local concern. But if you're flying and you see something and you kind of know what county or city it was, what's the likelihood if you call up their non-emergency number and say, "Hey, I'm Joe Blow. I just had this report of something flying over your city." What's the likelihood they will do something other than hang up in your face? So for the FAA to say report to local law enforcement, not really helpful. And I'm putting a graphic up on the screen here of a flight I took, but the same flight where I did the ASRS report because of the close encounter. I took off from Palo Alto, flew north, flew over San Francisco, in fact, over Alcatraz, north to Petaluma, did an approach, and came back. Now, during that trip, I was over several counties. I was over waterways that were the jurisdiction out of a particular county, probably a federal waterway. And if I saw something outside of my windscreen, let's say it was a couple miles away, I could kind of guess what city or county it was. But conceivably, I'd had to call six or seven of them to make sure that I got the got that covered. And again, if I called them, would they listen to me for more than 10 seconds? So again, the FAA has a process. It's not a very good process. Now,
we need to start taking that stuff a little more seriously.
So here's a basic question I ask myself. What's the use of reporting these things? Like John and I said, we have never seen an accident report, an incident report that involved a UAP where it hit an aircraft or whatever. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. Just that we've never seen a report. Personally speaking, if I were still working in academia and still in industry, and I was doing what I was doing with aviation safety, and I came across a report where the person said, I saw a flying saucer 50 feet outside of my window, and I made an abrupt turn to the right, and I had structural damage. I would not have mentioned the UFO part of it at all. I would have mentioned there was another vehicle nearby, seemed to be dangerously close, the pilot made an abrupt maneuver, you had this kind of damage to the airplane. There's no way I would have put that in there. Why? Because for my purposes, the fact that it was a UFO is irrelevant. What was relevant is this aircraft got damaged. Other parts of my company might be interested in what kind of damage happens when you have that kind of abrupt maneuver. And if I mention UFO in any part of that, I'd be laughed out of the room.
Yeah, you might still be today, even though we're more enlightened than we have been at any point in the past. You know, just admitting that we don't know everything. Look at the Voyager. The Voyager just discovered a huge amount of material that's out there and just beyond our piece of the sky. And we had no idea it was out there. It's got scientists going crazy.
This is a scientific project that has been going on for nearly 50 years. And it's still out there chugging along through the outer solar system reporting back. You know, and again, having the data is a good thing, especially if you don't even know what kind of questions to ask when you first start looking. It's only when you get into it and start getting more information, it's like, oh, we should ask a different kind of question to deal with this. Now, before I go further, one of the things I was emphasizing to my audience there is the difference between risk and safety. They're related. They're not the same thing. Risk can be objectively defined. It can be measured. And sometimes you can even hang a number on it. Safety is more of an acceptability of risk. So is it safe to have 300 people in an airplane closely packed together where they could all die at once? Well, there's risk involved. If that risk actually happens too many times, there'll be all sorts of changes in the industry. But so long as that risk doesn't manifest itself too much, it's safe. Now, there's a social aspect of it. Some safety issues are more important than others. And here's an example I like to use. If a plane crashes with 300 people on it, that's clearly a tragedy. It's a different kind of tragedy if those 300 people were mostly children between the ages of 5 and 7 going on a field trip, or 300 people who were prisoners being flown from one prison to another. Socially, there's a completely different response to that. The risk is the same. The safety perspective, much different. Now, where is the social aspect of risk? I ask myself, because risk, I like to be an objective guy. I know statistics, etc. There's no opinions in risk. Well, yes, there is. If you consider the risk important, it might be reported. It might be tracked. If the risk is considered not important, or the safety aspects of that risk are considered socially not important, you won't see anything. You know, before there were drones, by the millions, there were drones by the thousands. There was a risk there. but it wasn't considered to be something important. So there was no drone database back when drones were flown, once a day in a large state versus 10,000 times a day. Once you move to a realization that, hey, there's a lot more out there, and people who are flying them are not like who were flying them 10 years ago, the risk is something we should pay attention to. Now, I think UAPs are the same way. There's a potential of something happening. For example, you see something unusual coming at you, and you make an abrupt maneuver you don't have to, there's a risk involved. If this thing coming at you is an airplane, there's already a near mid-air collision database out there. It's like, hey, I saw a P-3 Orion coming at me. Full disclosure, this happened back in the 80s when I was flying in the Aero Club at Edwards Air Force Base. A P-3 Orion's coming straight at me. Holy moly, that's something that I have to pay attention to, maybe have to report. But if I saw something that was a big white blob that was going like this at me, I probably wouldn't. But I digress here. And again, that risk, I'm putting this other slide, that risk, the distinction between risk and safety is important because collecting the facts and the data is only one part of the safety process. If you don't recognize a risk as real or important, collecting facts and data about that risk becomes more difficult or next to impossible. Getting agreement on the definition of the components of risk informs the design of the data collection process. How risk is defined determines what data gets recorded and affects the quality of safety judgments based on that data. Now, one of the things I did was, for the purposes of this presentation, I'd like to come up with a definition of UAP, because if we're going to talk about UAPs as a risk, basic question is, what is a UAP? So this is not NASA. This is not the DoD. This is not Aero. This is not ASRS. This is me. What is a UAP, the aviation safety version? UAP should be defined before being analyzed. If you don't know where you're going, any rope will get you there. The definitions used by the military and the intelligence community may not work for civilian aviation. The approach used by NASA in their 2023 UAP report reflects a broader view of UAP that's more relevant to civil aviation. Civil aviation definitions should include natural phenomena, conventional and unconventional aerospace vehicles, and observations or effects that defy any categorization. Any reasonable definition would include UFOs. So here's my proposed definition. A UAP is a UFO or effects caused by UFO, aerospace vehicles behaving in unusual or unexpected ways, aerospace vehicles in unexpected situations or locations, natural phenomena that behave in unexpected ways, unknown phenomena producing unexpected effects on aircraft, aviation infrastructure, or people. So let me make it real for you. The airplane I fly most often is a Cessna 172. If you see me flying my Cessna 172 and I'm off your starboard wing and we're flying at 5,000 feet, that's nothing unusual. It's like, it's Todd and a Cessna. If you're flying a 747 or 787 or A350 at stratospheric altitudes and you see me keeping pace with you in my same Cessna, that's a UAP. A, it's well above the surface ceiling of a Cessna 172. B, it's well above the speed limitations of a Cessna 172. And C, if you see a Cessna 172 off your starboard wing at 35,000 feet, it's probably not a Cessna 172.
Probably. It can't be, right?
Now, here's one example from the NASA report. From mystery to explained phenomena. This is something called sprites or red sprites. This was essentially electromagnetic effects that go from the tops of thunderstorms to the lower reaches of space. This was seen decades ago by military pilots and such, but it was not well understood, and reporting it could have been detrimental to your career. It wasn't really formally studied in any great detail until about 40 years ago. Now they're well understood. But if you were able to take a picture of something like this in 1960, and you send it in to whomever, it's like, hey, I was flying in my U-2 at 60,000 feet. By the way, that's a secret aircraft you don't know about, but I was flying in my U-2 and I saw this. What are we going to do with this? It's like, well, first, Captain, we're going to ground you because you shouldn't be doing stuff that's not mission focused. Second, what the hell is that, Captain? Third, I don't want to deal with it. Go shut up and go, go to Shemya and enjoy the rest of your tour. Shemya is an island in the Aleutians where I guess there are no trees and there's a lot of bad weather. And if you really, really, really misbehave in the Air Force, when I was in at least, the joke was they'd send you to Shemya. Let's go straight to what I did as part of this presentation. I went to the actual ASRS database with the express purpose of finding UAP. And I did a basic search on the database. And again, you can do the same search. I did three searches. One of them, I just use the search terms UFO, UAP, unidentified flying object, unidentified anomalous phenomena. And I came up with nine where either in the narrative written by the reporter, the narrative written by NASA, those terms, one or more of them were there. There were nine. Six of them were potentially UAP. Did another search. This time was just missile. One word, missile. I got 63 records. I reviewed all 63. Four of them were potential UAP. My last one was UAV, which is an acronym for drones. There were 441 records. Three of them were possible UAP. Now, I know some of you are thinking, is Todd going to talk about this without giving us the good stuff? I'm going to go straight to the most ridiculous, outrageous one of all. It happened to be one of the UAV ones. And let me go there and read you, more or less verbatim, what this person said. The narrative, close encounter with UAV Sunday, 5 miles northeast of Windham High Peak in Greene County, New York, at about 3,500 feet. That's near Albany, by the way. I was piloting and had a passenger along with his for his first flight. This is a sailplane, unpowered aircraft. We could not see any kind of wings, rotors, or form of propulsion. Unfortunately, my camera was stuck in my pocket under tight seat belts, and I couldn't get it out while flying the glider, trying to avoid hitting this thing. Okay, this pilot did the right thing. When you have an unusual situation, A number one, you continue to fly the airplane. You maneuver the airplane to safety. And the last thing you do is report it. Now, reporting it could include calling on the radio or taking out your iPhone. This person did the right thing by not taking a picture. I'm not knocking this person at all. Let's go on. It was about 6 feet tall, 2 to 3 feet wide. The top of the UAV was extremely radiant, with black half sphere under the radiant top and what appeared to be an antenna under the half sphere. We watched it skimming over the treetops below and to the right of our flight path. It was moving at a fast speed southwest toward Windham High Peak. It had very high sparkling appearance like sun shining on a mirror with rainbow colors. I was flying northeast from Windham High Peak at about 3,500 feet. As we watched the UAV, I banked to the left and halfway through the turn, and now pointing at Windham High Peak, the UAV turned around and came toward us at a high rate of speed. As I got three quarters of the way through the turn, was within 50 yards of my right wing, quickly got in front of me and followed me around the turn, getting closer until it was off my left wing, probably no more than 25 to 30 yards away. It covered about 5 miles in just a few seconds. We had a really good view of it. Okay, let's take this apart. When I read this for the fourth or fifth time, I thought to myself, individual pieces of this are explainable. For example, let's get the year here. The year was 2015. So there were some sophisticated drones out there in 2015. And, something that's 6 feet tall, I can see something that big being a drone, probably too small to be a person. So inside of it, so it's remotely controlled. So having something that size and that appearance, I get that. That's possible. The next, the even the next thing, it came at me at a high rate of speed. Having an object come at you at a high rate of speed, no problem. But when you're talking about it passes off the right wing at 50 feet, was at a high rate of speed, comes around to the left side, it's like, wait a minute. This was covering 5 miles in just a few seconds. Well, even if it crossed 5 miles in 1 minute, that's about 300 knots. That's the speed a jet fighter might do maneuvering low toward the low and close to the ground. So to have something coming 300 knots at you like this and quickly turning around like that, we're talking a whole lot of G forces to do that. So again, not a person inside, so it's feasible that this was happening. Okay, it gets weirder. As I got off my left wing, my passenger looked up and saw two more UAVs come out of the cloud directly over us. At that point, I told my passenger we were returning immediately to the airport. Good idea. I pushed the nose down and picked up speed. UAVs then headed to the west at a fast speed. Okay, John, does anything about this narrative make any damn sense to you?
No, not really. I mean, something's going on. There's a phenomenon there that was going on that can't be explained. I wonder if it showed up on radar.
Well, it may not have shown up on radar, but it showed up in the minds of the people reviewing it at NASA, because they have, as part of this narrative, callback one, which I suspect is NASA calling back the pilot and asking for more information. The reporter estimated at first visual contact the UAV was approximately 3.5 miles away down the hill. It sped up the hill, uphill, to the reporter's aircraft at a much higher speed than the aircraft. The reporter estimated the closure took less than a minute. As he accelerated his aircraft away from the craft, it followed, maneuvering at a speed much higher than his. Two other similarly shaped UAVs also had brilliant tops, but colors somewhat different from the first, which was a shimmering, brilliant rainbow-type light. You might say to yourself, this person just made it up. Let me say this about that. If you're a certificated pilot, mechanic, flight attendant, whatever, and you lie to the government, many things can happen, few of them are good. So this person's ability to fly, ability to hold a certificate, was at risk if they lied. Their reputation was at risk if they lied. But here's someone who stood up, said what had to be said, reported it, responded when the NASA called him up again, and stood by his or her story. So again, I wasn't there. I haven't seen a video or picture, but this is a very compelling narrative to me. And oh, by the way, you might think it's a secret U.S. aircraft. I don't know of any places near Albany, New York, where you're going to have that sort of activity happening. And if you did, it would be highly unusual, extremely dangerous, and unprofessional to fly a secret aircraft or non-secret aircraft that close to a civilian aircraft, one that has much less capability of getting out of the way than yours. So it would have been foolhardy, foolish, crazy for someone to deliberately do this, whether they're working for the government or whether you're not working for the government. And again, this is a narrative which it makes no sense to me. They're clearly safety of flight things. But here's the big takeaway. This pilot did it right. Pilot didn't panic. Pilot didn't try to take a photo of it. Didn't try to emergency land the airplane because this thing was flying, 30 yards off their wing. They calmly dealt with the situation and safely landed the airplane. So, bravo.
Wow. Well, I think we scared all our listeners.
Scared me looking at this thing. By the way, there are 13 total. I have a whole list of all these. It's in another document. So we have the NASA report. We have these 13, including the search terms I use. And we also have my slide deck from the presentation and a link to the video I talked about with the Starlinks going by. So, check it out. Okay. NASRS, keep up the good work. It's like, you're doing great stuff. No advertising. You got at least 13 great pieces of information there. And for all of you out there, especially if it happened recently, if you had an event where, it doesn't have to be looking like a UFO. It could be something that's just completely baffling to you. You're a mechanic. You have a device coming in for a repair. It has all sorts of squirrely things happening to it. And you understand from the crew that brought that in that they were in a certain situation. It's like, okay, I'm a mechanic. I've been working for 30 years doing this. I've never seen anything even close to this. So whatever encounter these folks had, they shouldn't have it again. And anybody who can avoid it should avoid it.
Yes. Okay, Todd, we'll let you give the last word.
Well, my last word is, I'm an inquisitive kind of guy. And, I kept asking questions until I got some answers. Some of the answers made me so upset. It's like, gee, I should keep talking about this and get it to a wider audience. It doesn't have to be about UAP. It could be about whatever it is interests you about aviation. So my advice to you is, doesn't matter if you have the credentials to do so. I don't have credentials to be a UAP researcher. Go out there and do it. Have some fun.
Okay. And as usual, I will talk very briefly. If you're going to go flying, do a good session of pre-planning. Do it at home or in the hotel, and then do it again at the airport. Free flight your airplane. I was just at Oshkosh. I had the opportunity to look at several Warbird airplanes, a couple, and three or four general aviation pilots doing walk-arounds on their airplanes. Considerably different between the two, but I will say the GA pilots that I saw, the three or four that I saw, were very conscientious in their pre-flights. I don't know anything about them. I just was quietly sitting and observing. So you need to do a good pre-flight. I mean, it just hurts when I go through these accident reports and I see that the pre-flight would have had an impact on the outcome of the event. So please do a good pre-flight. And when you get in the air, put your head on a swivel. Boy, I'll tell you what, it was 10,000 airplanes out in Oshkosh. If you didn't have your head on the swivel, you were going to be in serious trouble quickly. Because once you get out of the immediate area, it's uncontrolled airspace. And boy, that was a busy, busy place. So please, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.